Hello there, my name is Jamie Adams.
My name is Oliver Kinner.
And I'm Ian McAllister, and this is Brainwaves episode 139, bringing you the best in tabletop gaming news. These are the headlines for the week of 25th of March, 2024. Ninja Division files for bankruptcy. Hasbro presents a compelling case for AI. And Czech Games Edition acquires a new factory. All this and more on this episode of Brainwaves.
Over the last few years, it's been our sad duty to report on the collapse of several gaming companies, and today we have to add another one to the list. Ninja Division, the publisher behind Super Dungeon Explore, has filed for bankruptcy. The company made a name for itself around 2014 from its Super Dungeon Explore game, and went on to fund other games through crowdfunding over the following years. The bankruptcy filing said the company had debts of $1 to $10 million and assets of up to $100,000. Now, the issues began way back in 2016 during the development of Super Dungeon Explore Legends. The company said lukewarm feedback to the in-development game set them back to the drawing board. The ramifications of that decision rippled out and have led to the game being delayed many times since the title funded. The game raised $1,290,522 from 6,611 backers. By 2017, the company had exhausted the funds to produce the game and estimated they needed another $750,000 to complete it. In 2019, the company had let go many of its staff, and it seems now the situation has reached an end. The comments on the Kickstarter are understandably angry. ICV2 reported that co-owner John Cadiz said they would no longer be using Kickstarter due to the toxicity of users on the platform. So, am I right in saying that they haven't actually funded or delivered the game that funded back in 2016?
They have not funded, they have not delivered Super Dungeon Explore Legends. And obviously, backers are incredibly angry about that because it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
And the co-owner, John Cadiz, has come out and said that, you know, people are toxic on Kickstarter, which I admit to some extent, people can be a little toxic on that platform.
Absolutely.
And it's not very well regulated. But to say that while you're also filing for bankruptcy and telling those backers that they can't get the things they have paid for is a bit much.
Bad timing, I'd call it, or not being diplomatic, maybe. But yeah, and I get that. You know, obviously, backers will be angry. It's understandable. But at the same time, as we keep saying, this is a crowdfunding platform. There's no guarantee you will get your product. And even those platforms, and some of them sort of have like promises in there and sorts of guarantees in quotes. But in reality, you pay towards a project. If you get the product that's promised at the end, may not happen. So beware.
Yeah, no crowdfunding platform is a store, much as especially Kickstarter would like you to consider it to be like a storefront. They absolutely are not. There's a bunch of new ones sprung up over the last few years, obviously, like GamePound, BackerKit have all come onto the scene and become crowdfunding platforms in their own right.
None of them are stores.
None of them are stores. You are basically gambling on whether you're going to get your product or not.
In other news, water continues to be wet. The sky continues to be blue, depending on the level of air pollution in your current vicinity. And crowdfunding sites continue to be not stores and not dodgy, but just beware.
Buyers beware. And in continuing news, we also know about AI being AI, if I may lead on to the next story. As reported by Dicebreak on the 15th of March, Hasbro CEO Chris Cox recently announced plans for the use of AI technology within the company that owns Dungeons & Dragons and Magic the Gathering. When speaking to Games Beat at Dice Summit on the 1st of March, Cox describes how Hasbro is planning on training a large language model similar to ChatGPT using the company's entire RPG catalogue of official releases. Cox says of the plans,
"This is cutting-edge technology, and Hasbro is a 100-year-old company. When you talk about the richness of the lore and the depth of the brands, D&D has 50 years of content that we can mine. Literally thousands of adventures that we've created, probably tens of millions of words we own and can leverage. Magic the Gathering has been around for 35 years, more than 15,000 cards we can use and something like that. We can leverage all that to be able to build very interesting and compelling use cases for AI that can bring our characters to life. We can build tools that aid in content creation for users or create really interesting gamified scenarios around them."
According to Cox, Hasbro has already experimented with the technology through its Peppa Pig and Transformers brands. The AI tools developed for these two non-gaming brands are currently aimed at adults to make sure all the content is appropriate. Cox goes on to say,
"We're doing R&D efforts around AI. I think most major entertainment and IP holders are at least thinking about it. The key there is the responsible use of it. We have an even higher bar we need to hit because we service audiences of all ages. We go from preschoolers on up to adulthood. I don't think we can be very cavalier in how we think about AI. That said, it's exciting. There's a lot of potential for delighting audiences. We need to make sure that we do it in a way that respects the creators we work with, respects their works of art, respects their ownership of those works, and also creates a fun and safe environment for kids who might use it."
It sounds like some of Hasbro's goals for D&D are to make character and interactive map creation easier using the generative AI tools that they are developing.
There's a lot of potential for delighting audiences. There's also a lot of potential for fleecing them out of money and producing substandard quality stuff.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it obviously we have to be a bit careful here, because what Cox are saying is that they're going to train their own AI system on their own work that they own, that they have a copyright for, that's theirs, which is obviously different to something like Midjourney that just, you know, steals stuff from other creators. But I think you two have probably some comments on that.
Well, interestingly, I am pretty sure, like, so the DMs Guild, if you're not familiar with, is like a Dungeons & Dragons portal where people can make their own content and put it up on DMs Guild, and like adventures, supplements, that kind of thing. And they get a cut of what is sold there, and Wizards get a very, very large cut. I think we reported on that in the past. It's something around the 60-70% region that Wizards take from that site. And I'm pretty sure within those rules and the terms and conditions, it'll effectively say that Wizards owns those products that are on there. So if that's right, I'm pretty sure it is, they'll be using work created by people under the OGL, which they tried to cancel at the start of last year, in order to train an AI to make future adventures for that site. Awesome.
Yeah. And I think the other thing of this is this is obviously a company that likes to make profit. So even if this tool, whether you like it or not, starts out as free and will make it easier for people like me who don't know much about D&D to create my own adventures and make them interactive and make maps and all that just by plugging in some words, however it's going to work, eventually probably if it does take off, it'll cost something at some point.
People like me
who'll be the alpha testers to make sure there's nothing rude going out there. That'll become available to a wider audience, and then at some point you'll have to pay for it. So whatever you think, how legal or illegal this is, or ethical or non-ethical, either way, I think we're looking at a tool that will make basically put people out of work who are genuinely trying to do good for the D&D world and all that, as well as then charge consumers. So
yeah, it's an interesting one that the sort of rumor that Wizards were looking at, like, sort of some sort of software that would allow you to like have a virtual dungeon master, so someone to run your game of Dungeons and Dragons for you. Because one of the bottlenecks for RPGs in general is the folk that are willing to sit down, learn games, and run them for you. That is like the bottleneck of like how many games can be run effectively. So if you could create something that like basically is a virtual DM through some sort of AI system, that would be extremely valuable to Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro, because then there'd be no limit as to the number of people that could run their games. And of course, they are looking at implementing their own virtual sort of tabletop kind of thing at some point over the next couple of years, probably with the launch of 6th edition or 1D&D or whatever it's going to be called later this year. I'd imagine that's going to be around about Gen Con come August in the States. That's going to happen, all those launches. So, yeah, it's a company that's going to be looking at technology in order to enhance its games, and AI is the current sort of technology du jour, whether that lasts or not, or whether it sort of like fizzles because it's incredibly expensive and there's a massive backlash against it for obvious reasons. Who knows?
Let's move away from AI and on to industries.
Yes, indeed, Jamie. In a press release dated the 24th of March, Chex Games Edition, or CGE, announced that they have become the co-owner of long-standing manufacturing partner Orion's Carton. CGE is the Czech Republic-based publisher of titles including Through the Ages, Codenames, and the recent Kuntahora, The City of Silver. Orion's Carton is a board game and puzzle production facility which CGE has used almost since its inception 17 years ago. Ludofact, which co-founded Orion's Carton in 2004, is going to remain co-owner of the facility. In a statement, CGE said,
"The decision to acquire our own production facility feels like a natural next step for CGE as we've grown with each passing year. This acquisition allows us to further optimize the facility's manufacturing processes. Now, we can adjust the production pipeline to better suit our needs and the needs of our games, which will allow us to try new things when it comes to how our games are manufactured. We've already tried using new material, ReWood, for the first time in Kuntahora, the City of Silver, last year, and we're looking forward to continuing, exploring and bringing new possibilities and materials to board game manufacturing."
The manufacturing facility will not be exclusive to CGE, and German board game partner Heidelberg Games has already been producing games there. CGE is actively inviting other companies to use the facility. In their statement, they say,
"With this, we would like to extend an invitation to game publishers worldwide, offering them an opportunity to utilize our factory for production of both board games and jigsaw puzzles, and associated logistical needs. If you're interested in producing in the Czech Republic, or would just like to hear more, please contact us at production@czechgames.com.
Now, obviously, producing in China is quite cheap. It's what a lot of board game companies do at the moment, but it comes with environmental and many ethical costs, and it's nice to see a company now offering alternatives to board game publishers in Europe, which can only be welcomed. I would imagine we're going to see CGE moving into more of the sort of production side of things for other companies with this acquisition. You got any thoughts on that, Oliver?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think smaller indie publishers have that problem trying to obviously produce as cheaply as possible. But even back in the days, I remember Rem Games using a German company to print their games locally, and they just believed in that. And I just like to see that more. But I do appreciate that, obviously, especially for smaller publishers, it's easier in some ways, or cheaper at least, to produce in China. So I get that. But yeah, the more opportunities we have within Europe, or at least closer to home, as I said, whatever closer means to wherever you are in the world, of course, the better. Because then, you know, hopefully costs will come down, prices will come down. So let's have more manufacturing facilities closer to the UK, closer within Europe, and see that happening. But yeah, I appreciate in the meantime, it might just be too cost prohibitive for publishers to produce locally.
Well, there's a time cost as well there, because we're seeing problems in the Red Sea at the moment with shipping. And it's not only hitting people for cost, but also like the length of time it's taking to get things around the world. So being able to produce something more locally and then maybe ship it across in lorries rather than ships and that kind of thing across Europe is maybe better, maybe a little bit more expensive, but at least people are going to get their games in time. So yeah, it is good to see more manufacturing sort of hubs sort of spring up across the world where things can be manufactured locally. It's always good to see.
Now moving on to some updates.
Yes, back in episode 130, we reported that German game manufacturer Haber had entered voluntary insolvency to try and arrest the collapse of the company. Haber exited insolvency on the 29th of February 2024. The insolvency involved a restructuring of the company and the loss of 600 jobs. Martin Mucher, a restructuring expert at law firm Grupp Brugger, who supported Haber's efforts over the period, said,
"Over the past few months, we have worked intensively on a clear brand positioning, viable cost structures, and a sustainable internal and external positioning of the company. We have succeeded in setting the course for a successful future for Haber Family Group, so that the company can continue its 85-year tradition."
Dr. Mario Wilhelm, Managing Director of Haber Family Group, said,
"The end of the self-administration proceedings marks an important milestone on our path into the future. We are sending an important signal to our customers, suppliers, and the Upper Franconian region."
The company will continue to be steered by an external committee designed to keep the business on track. According to the statement,
"The strategy for the Haber brand entails a focus on high-quality toys and games aimed at children's development, while Haber Pro aims to further expand its market leadership in furniture for daycare centres and all-day facilities."
So yes, it was good to see Haber come out of insolvency. obviously, that meant shedding a lot of jobs. I mean, we're talking 600 people lost their job. Hopefully, all of these people have found new work in the meantime. As always, you know, we, as a Brainwave team, we hope that has happened.
Yeah.
It's mixed news. And to be honest, actually, personally, I didn't even realize that was a thing. Once you've come out of insolvency, you sort of carry on again and you come out of it. I thought it's usually you bought out and it sort of changes management and whatever, rather than you sort of carry on.
Yeah, I don't know fully because I haven't looked into the legal ramifications in Germany, but it seemed to be that what HABA did wasn't, they didn't become insolvent. They sort of voluntarily became insolvent at that point. So they entered in some sort of slightly odd administration proceedings in Germany where it allowed them to sort of like sort things out and then exit that proceedings.
Yeah, I think you have something similar in the US where you have like bankruptcy protection. So you carry on trading under, obviously guided by an sort of external team or whatever, external committee in this case. So I guess that's something similar.
Yeah, bankruptcy, isn't it? Or is that
Something like that, yeah.
You get similar things in the UK as well. We were just recently seen in the bike industry, Wiggle and Chain Reaction go under, but they were got bought by another company and those names are going to continue. It's not quite the same thing, but like that company, the company name and brand effectively gets to continue under a new ownership.
Yeah, and that's what I was sort of expecting, that it's sort of bought out a new ownership. Yeah. Maybe some of the people are kept on, sort of, you know, the higher management. But this sounds like nothing has changed. Everyone's still there and people have lost their jobs, which I think is a negative message here. On the other hand, obviously having a brand like HABA continue is important because they are, you know, long tradition, 85-year-old company. So don't know what to say, really.
Yeah, they've made some great games. They made some Spiel des Jahres winning games as well. So who knows what we'll see for that company in the future in terms of sort of the hobby games market. It sounds like they're maybe going to be refocusing on the wider sort of toys market rather than what we're used to seeing out of HABA.
Now on to the news.
We don't normally cover press releases unless things are very interesting enough to us. This story definitely piqued our interest. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, better known as NASA, the American space people, have released an RPG adventure, The Lost Universe. They released it for free on their website and was designed to be adaptable to the game system of the player's choice. However, most descriptions clearly suggest a D&D bent, as it says on the page, for level 7 to 10 characters. And I'm sure there are lots of game systems that have level 7 to 10. Most of the time it's Dungeons & Dragons. A dark mystery has settled over the city of Aldestron on the rogue planet of Ixlaris. Researchers dedicated to studying the cosmos have disappeared, and the Hubble Space Telescope has vanished from Earth's timeline. Only an ambitious crew of adventurers can uncover what was lost. Are you up to the challenge? Now, NASA and nerddom goes hand in hand. Famously, Star Trek fans petitioned NASA to name one of their space shuttles Enterprise, which NASA did. And I'm sure there's lots and lots of other things I can't think of at this current moment in time. It's interesting, you know, it's cool that they're bringing out their own RPG, but what precedent is this setting? Are other US government agencies going to publish their own RPG adventures? Because if they are, I, for one, would not like to see what the CIA one is going to be.
Or ICE.
Well, I must say, I think there's so many stories in the US nowadays. Lots of adventures that we could develop.
Oh, yeah.
Political ones otherwise, so lots of material there.
Lots of material all over the world, you know, South Central America. And, anyway, yeah.
But, it's really interesting to see such a gigantic national agency do something like this, because it's just another one of those signs that we've been talking about over the last sort of 2-3 years that like the role-playing hobby has really entered sort of the mainstream consciousness of popular culture. Yeah, fascinating.
Oh, absolutely.
Nice to see. Yeah, definitely. Moving from NASA to Wingspan.
Did someone say Wingspan, the cultural juggernaut from Stonemaier Games?
Was it Wormspan?
I'm about to say that. Okay, Stonemaier Games, publishers of Scythe and the cultural juggernaut, yes, Jamie, I'm saying it, that is Wingspan, has filed its most recent financial reports for its shareholders. Stonemaier made $16.7 million in the last financial year. This was down from $20.7 million in 2022. But the company stated that profits were up due to some better relationships with partners and a look at their logistics. In the update, Jamie Stegmaier, the owner of the company, says that Stonemaier currently has no debt and has taken no loans in 2023. He mentions the tight cash flow the company sometimes has, saying,
"As usual, cash flow was tight at certain times of the year due to the gap between when we need to pay Panda, our manufacturer, and when distributors pay us, but we make it work. I mention this to dispel the notion that profitable companies are always flush with cash."
Stonemaier Games breaks down all the comings and goings from the company, as well as the sales of all their games. The best-selling game is still Wingspan by a country mile. That title is approaching 2 million copies sold. Scythe takes second place, and then Viticulture. The full report gives a breakdown of the marketing the company has carried out, and also has details of the conventions the company attends, and the numbers of company cats and dogs, should that be of interest.
I know that there was another report recently saying numbers of Wingspan copies sold had fallen again, like for a second year running. But nevertheless, looking at this financial report, it still seems things are coming up roses for Stonemaier.
Yeah, I mean, it's down, and people have drawn comparisons with the height of the pandemic in terms of their profits, but that's an unfair comparison, in my opinion. We all know that, like, tabletop game companies had a massive boon over 2020 and 2021. Things were all bound to go downhill a bit after that period. So I think they're doing pretty well. Like, the report says their profit level is actually up, even though the sort of gross turnover is down. And it's an interesting thing to see a precise breakdown for a tabletop games company, because we see it so rarely. And one of the reasons that Brainwaves reports on Stonemaier Games so often is that they actually give a breakdown of their finances, what they're up to. Jamie is extremely open about how the company operates, what profits is, as he says in that report, when cash flow is tight as well. And it's an interesting bellwether for the industry. They're not a large company, but they're sort of one of the medium-sized companies that we see a lot of in the hobby. So yeah, they're a really good indicator of how things are going for that size of company.
Definitely the numbers as well. I mean, just, you know, 2 million copies of any game sold.
Yeah, that is incredible, right?
I mean, you look at smaller print runs of 1,000 copies, then maybe if a game is lucky, it sells 10,000 copies, maybe a bit more, but we're talking about millions here. It's just immense. And then even like whether it's profits or revenue, I can't remember, but even those figures they're talking about, it's just crazy. It's just clearly a company is doing very well. And I know there have been complaints, like with Wormspan coming out, is Stonemaier just cashing in on something that works? And I always say, well, why not?
Yeah, you know, I mean,
people buy it, then go for it. But it's just, they're clearly doing something right. And as much as you like or don't like Stonemaier, they're doing something right. And I think ultimately, I'd say they're quite open. So Jamie often talks about the business, obviously doesn't reveal all the details, but there's a lot of information here that you don't hear from other publishers, whether big or small. So seeing this, it's just great to see. So,
Yeah, and the Giant Brain has reviewed some of Stonemaier Games, so we should say that. But one of the reasons that we are on that their sort of reviewer group is that Jamie's very open about how he does that. Basically, I can get a game if I don't currently have one. I review it. Once I've done that, I can then get another one. And Jamie doesn't read reviews. He just puts them up on the site. And every time I've done a review, he's been good to his word. So it's the sort of way I'd like most board game companies to operate, quite frankly, in terms of like reviewer-publisher relationships. It's really good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Huge respect.
Now, Jamie, we'd like to move on to an obituary.
Tabletop games designer James M. Ward has died, age 72. For 20 years, James worked at TSR, the original publishers of Dungeons & Dragons, and was possibly most well-known for the sourcebook Deities and Demigods, which provided in-game stats for deities of various religions and belief systems around our world, and some mythic folklore characters as well. As well as Metamorphosis Alpha, an early sci-fi RPG. Now, after his work at TSR, which he left in 1996, he helped design a lot of collectible card games as part of the boom of that particular system in the late 90s, including The Wheel of Time, Babylon 5, and Dragon Ball Z. Also, James was an early playtester of what would become Dungeons & Dragons, at the table of E. Gary Gygax, and was immortalized in various settings as Dromidge the Wizard. Now, in 1989, he was inducted into the Academy of Adventure Gaming Arts and Design Hall of Fame, and he leaves behind a huge legacy, maybe the most important being his helping shape D&D. Thoughts of Brainwave's team are with his family, and what an amazing body of work and legacy that he leaves behind.
Yeah, I have played the Babylon 5 CCG quite a bit during the mid-90s CCG glut that was part of, but it was really good. It was an interesting game. It was good fun. Now we're going to move on to some jobs, opportunities, and events.
Yes, as always, the Brainwaves team would like to point you towards the Tabletop Jobs Facebook group, where there are jobs, obviously, for the board game, tabletop games industry of all kinds, marketing positions, quite a few US-based ones, quite a few UK-based ones, and I think I suppose some other European-based ones as well. So always worth checking out that group, as always worth having a look. And then we have news of the BRP Design Challenge. Chaosium announces their basic role-playing design, BRP Challenge, which wants to assist new and upcoming creators financially to bring their games to independent publication, either digitally or in print. Chaosium is looking for designers from all walks of life with original ideas, concepts, and systems. If you're interested, you need to provide a pitch for your game, a production budget, an outline of how the financial support will make your game a reality, a competitor market analysis of your game, showcasing where it fits in the market, how the BRP rules have been used in your game, and what makes the use of the BRP system, the setting, and or the gameplay experience of your design unique. Entry is free and all entrants retain ownership of the work in its entirety. There's a link in the show notes to a page with more details of the prizes on offer, the entry form, and everything else you need to take part. Now, Ian, I think you got some quick events updates as well.
Yes, I have just been to Aircon, which is a sort of play-focused event down in Harrogate every year in England. You can read all about that on the site. I've got 3 days of convention reports up on the site right now. You can read about all the games I've played. Played 29 games over 3 days. It was a really good con. Saw lots of people, made lots of new friends. It was fantastic. And this coming week, this is going out on the 25th of March, so on Thursday of the week of release, I'll be flying over to Sweden as a guest at GothCon in Gothenburg. This is a sort of convention in Gothenburg that's a little RPG focused, but it's got board games, war games, all sorts of things going on. I'll be over there as a guest. I'm going to be running a game of Blades in the Dark in front of an audience on mic, which is going to be an interesting experience because I've never done that before. And I'm also running a panel on the state of RPG criticism in 2024. It will be recorded, and we're going to put both of those out on the Brainwaves channel at some point in the not too distant future. They're going to be recorded. I'll get the audio for those and get those out once they are ready. The review one especially, I think, will get a little spicy because TLDR, the state of RPG criticism in 2024, is not very good.
And I'm not going.
And I can't wait to hear all about it.
Yeah, me too.
Jamie's staying at home.
Sort of.
Next time. Yeah, so yeah, if you are GothCon, do come and say hello. It'd be lovely to meet you. And I'm really looking forward to experiencing what the sort of Sweden gaming culture has to offer.
And please, if you do go to GothCon, please ask Ian about his favourite Joy Division songs.
Anyway, we'd just like to take a little moment to thank our patrons. Thank you so much for continuing to support the cast in these difficult financial times, especially our executive producers, Kevin Bertram from Fort Circle Games, James Naylor from Naylor Games, and Sean Newman from the Gamelot team. I just paid the WordPress subscription for the year, and your financial help really supports the cast and helps us sort of keep the cast going and the site as well. It's really, really appreciated. If you'd like to join our patrons, you can do so from only $1 a month. It really helps us out. And any way you'd like to support us, even if that's just a share of the articles or the cast, that it helps us out a lot because podcast discoverability is not very good. There's various other ways to support us if you don't want to sign up to Patreon on the site, including buying dice from FanRoll and also t-shirts from Sir Meeple. And there's a couple of other ways to support us directly on there as well. Do go and check that out. But Jamie, it's time for your yearly sort of brainwaves review. And yet again, you have failed to bring us any Monopoly news.
Sorry, I wasn't told that there was a yearly review. So actually, I think you're...
It's in your contract.
I know you never gave me a contract to sign. Therefore, I am obliged to not provide you with Monopoly news, but to provide you with other kind of news, such as Uno news.
I was going
to
say, I'm a great fan of this next article, so go for it.
Great. Oh, good. I'm glad.
This next story.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you. First of all, I'd like to preface with a very quick thing in that I've always had a beef with elitism in the gaming circles and people going, you like this game? For example, although we rag on Monopoly a lot, I don't hate people for playing it. If you enjoy Monopoly, brilliant. I'm really glad you get some enjoyment out of that. I don't personally. I'm glad you do. Same thing said for Uno. I really like Uno. There's a lot of people who don't. I don't think Ian's a big fan.
No, I'm not.
Fair enough. There we go. But in a similar manner to Monopoly stories, this is mainly about intellectual property and games that we know. So this is Uno with some fandom-based decks. So decks seem to run, well, there's about four or five of them, and each have their own special rules. So I'm going to quickly go through some of them that are being released. The first one is going to be Uno Disney Villains. The deck will include a special Maleficent's Gift rule, letting any player give four extra cards to a player or players of their choice. If you like your Disney villains, I mean, there are some absolutely amazing Disney villains, wonderful songs. There is Masters of the Universe, that TV show that was originally made to sell toys. It has a special Armory of the Grey Skull rule that lets a player take action cards from other players to build up their arsenal. Now, before you ask, how do all these rules work? I don't know. The next one, we have Monster High. Now, I believe that is something to do with monsters and secondary school age people, which has a collectible card and a special Frankie's Hand rule, which will enable a player to look at another player's hand, take the card of their choice, and replace it with one of their own. Always a useful thing in other card games, but I think very useful in Uno. Then we have Avatar The Last Airbender. Now, it's a deck that shows off all four nations' bending abilities, because I was realizing that there are only four colors, so I assume they're going to be Earth, Air, Fire, and Water. But the Avatar State rule, which will allow a player to take a turn any time they want, providing they have all four colors in their hand. The last one I'm going to talk about is Star Trek. There is a Star Trek Uno deck coming with the Mirror Mirror rule, as a nod to the Mirror Universe that is featured in many, many of the series, which will force a chosen player to draw cards until they have as many in their hand as the player with the most cards. Now, if you put all those decks together, A, it would be a mess, but B, a lot of very interesting rules to try.
Yeah. I mean, I'm disappointed that the Mirror Mirror one doesn't force players to get into, for some reason, slinky leather outfits, because that is generally what happened in Mirror Mirror episodes.
Okay, so first of all, I think you're thinking of only a couple of Mirror Universe episodes, Ian, and get your mind out of there. Second of all, you're not a fan of Uno anyway. Do you want to spend more time playing Uno where you have to get in and out of things?
No.
I like Uno.
It's fine, but no more than that.
Do you know what? Sometimes a game being fine is just that, and the level of accessibility is sometimes its greatest strength.
Maybe.
True words.
Oh, sorry, Ian. What was that? Maybe. Or are we going to do this right now? Are you saying accessibility is a problem, Ian?
No, we're not going to do this just now. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. If you like what you listen to, then the best way to help us out is to share the podcast and drop us a review and rating on iTunes. You can also follow us, you can follow Oliver at his blog, tabletopgamesblog.com, and please do so. You can join us on our Discord. We'll put an invite in the show notes. We are no longer on Twitter, but you can find us on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can look at all the podcasts and articles we write at giantbrain.co.uk. And if you'd like to email us about anything in the cast or any articles you think we should be covering on the cast, then please do email us at giantbrainuk@gmail.com. If you'd like to talk to us anonymously about anything that's going on in the tabletop games industry, your anonymity is guaranteed. Thanks very much for listening, folks. We'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let us know if you like Uno.